Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-5131, Montanians for Multiple Use, a not-for-profit organization et al., Appellants versus Kathy Barbaletos, Flathead National Forest Supervisor et al. Mr. Pollitt for the appellants, Mr. Gray for the appellees.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Pollitt. I am attorney of record for all appellants in this action. Of course, I do not want to simply repeat that which is in my brief. I know you've read it, and so what I will try to do is give a brief summary of where we are, what our arguments are, and then stand for any questions that you may have. And I've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, this case was filed in the district court below in June of 2003. It is now January of 2009, approximately 5.5 years since we filed this case, and more than 4 years after the court below was informed that the Forest Service plan revision would be finished in approximately 1 year. Right now, we are faced with a plan that is approximately 23 years old, the revision for which, according to the statutory deadline, is 8 years overdue.
Well, Congress keeps extending that, though, right?
Your Honor, what they have done is to provide a safe harbor in which the, as long as the Secretary is acting expeditiously and in good faith, which appellants believe is a dual requirement, they must do both, then the mere passage of 15 years alone is not sufficient. What we have alleged below and what we submit is the case are several things, one of which is that at the time that the motion for judgment on the pleadings was heard, that safe harbor provision had expired and was not renewed until 2008, and we submit that the rule of decision at the time this matter was submitted, there was no safe harbor provision in effect. We also have argued
when the law changes during the pendency of an appeal, don't we apply the law as of the time of the appeal?
I think that in some cases that is true, Your Honor. I think in other cases, however, that when Congress has chosen not to do something and then comes along later, it is protecting the agency against appeals from that point, or not appeals, but from cases from that point forward. But even if that is, in fact, the position that Congress has intended to go back retroactively and to cover cases that have already been submitted for decision, we submit that we have more than adequately alleged in the complaint that the Secretary was acting neither expeditiously nor in good faith. The complaint, as we have shown, and I won't go through all of the page citations in our brief, alleged repeatedly that the Forest Service was deliberately dragging its feet, deliberately taking what were substantial changes that required a considerable amount of public review and environmental review, and chopping them into smaller pieces and misleading the public and denying the public of their opportunity to go forward. In fact, one of the things that we very strongly argue in our brief is that the court below erred in looking at whether the actions that we allege we were barred from seeking a remedy for because of a failure to exhaust administrative remedies. And we suggest and submit that the reason that the court was wrong about that is that those allegations were not in there to ask the court to undo those actions because they were a de facto amendment. In fact, we didn't make that request in our prayer for relief at all. We simply asked the court to bar the agency from making further amendments to the plan while they should be revising the plan, using up utilizing the resources that were to go into a plan revision to continue to amend an existing plan. The allegations in claims 1 and 2 had to do with showing a pattern and practice on the part of the Forest Service to avoid the revision process and to and the very fact that they were using those resources to continue to amend the plan. And at the time we were before the court below, they were processing yet another amendment, amendment number 24, down there, and utilizing resources that should have gone into the revision of the plan.
Can I call your attention to some language in opinion of ours, which actually quotes the Supreme Court opinion, and then I want to ask you a question about what you just said. The language I wanted to quote is actually from Mountain States Legal Foundation versus Bush, and it, quoting Papasan, a Supreme Court decision, it says that the court is supposed to take all factual allegations in the complaint as true, but is not bound to accept as true a legal conclusion couched as a factual allegation. Now, with that as background, how is a court supposed to distinguish between a bunch of periodic small amendments? How is the court supposed to conclude that a bunch of periodic small amendments manifest an intention to avoid the procedural requirements associated with revision?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the standard also requires that all reasonable inferences that can be drawn from factual allegations must be drawn in favor of the non-moving party.
What are the factual allegations that push one at all to the side of thinking that this is some sort of evasive activity as opposed to just confronting a succession of problems and responding to them?
Your Honor, I believe the answer to that comes in two parts, one of which, of course, is that what you're speaking of goes to the issue of bad faith. It does not go to the issue of inexpedition, and I think that the factual allegations as far as inexpedition are concerned are clear. They had a statutory mandate. They had a deadline in which they were at least to begin the process. Instead of beginning that process, they continued to utilize resources that would have been required for the plan revision to continue to do amendments, and therefore set existing management direction for the new plan whenever it was they intended to get around to it. We have also alleged that the reason that they were taking these actions is that they were trying to satisfy particular constituencies out there and were acting not out of a concern for doing the processes required by law, but in satisfying those constituencies and avoiding the obligation to go forward and do what requires a large public and a NEPA process. In fact, even now, the Forest Service attempted to amend its regulations to do away with the requirement for a NEPA review during the planning process on the argument that somehow or other the plan itself doesn't have any impact, which is untrue, because the Forest Service itself has said that it is bound then to follow that management direction in the future. And by dividing these things into smaller parts, we've also alleged that the Forest Service knew that if this was done in a large group, they would have to do the environmental review, and were attempting at all costs to avoid having to do so.
If the Congress agreed with your assessment of what's going on here, presumably they wouldn't keep extending the deadline.
Your Honor, I would have to respectfully say that I'm not sure that Congress is particularly aware of individual actions by the agency. In fact, one of our claims here obviously being...
Well, someone in Congress must be, because they keep doing this, correct?
I would not sure that I would necessarily agree with that they were asked to do it. There have been large blocks of time in which they have not done it, and as we suggest,
Has there been any effort to convince the Congress that perhaps extending the time is not a good idea for the reasons you express here?
Respectfully, Your Honor, no, because they contain a provision in all of these safe harbor enactments out there that if the the secretary is not acting expeditiously or in good faith, then those protections don't apply, which implies that Congress at least knows the possibility that they don't want to extend a blanket protection, that there are people who are going to be dragging their feet out there. And when you have a case like this where it is, you know, 23 years now since the first plan was completed, and the Forest Service has said even before that they were going to get it done in a year when we were before the district court, and now they have planning regulations they attempted to adopt which are now being challenged, so the whole planning process is in abeyance once again. And if the agency can continue to tinker with the process by adopting small amendments, changing the rules for planning, and then saying we cannot plan until the new rules are go into effect, then they can postpone these plan remission or these plan revisions indefinitely, and that seems to be where we are right now. Moving on, I don't think I want to spend a great deal of time on the issue of exhaustion of administrative remedies. I think that we briefed that extensively out there, and the bottom line comes down to the claims 1 and 2 have to do with a failure to act in the future, to do things that they are mandated by Congress. And, of course, if they have failed to do something, there is no decision document, there is no appeal procedure to go to try to challenge an inaction. Again, I think the court below misconstrued our first two claims as trying to undo things that they had done in this cumulative process, rather than simply asking a court to put an end to that process so the revision process could begin and the resources that are being devoted to amendments could go forward, and not allow the Forest Service to avoid the plan revision process by setting existing management direction that could then be incorporated into the plan. So unless the court has some questions about that, I would like to move on to the other two claims. The first claim that I want to go to is the government's Quiet Title Act claim. This is a claim that the government resorts to whenever there is a private property right that is adjacent to or crosses federal land. They try to treat this as a title dispute, but what the claim we have made was that there was a physical invasion and occupancy of the rights of way owned by the counties. Now, there are two sets of plaintiffs. It's important to keep in mind. One set of plaintiffs includes the county who have a property interest in the rights of way, which they allege were taken by the physical invasion and occupancy of those rights of way, closing them. There's no administrative procedure that exists to appeal somebody who has gone in and put rocks in a way. And if we go by Loretto versus Teleprompter Cable Company, the smallest physical invasion and occupancy of a property is a per se taking. Even if they come along later and remove the obstructions, there at least is a temporary taking. And as we have alleged in our complaint, Federal Land Policy Management Act prohibits a taking that would otherwise be, well, what they have done is they've withdrawn the Tucker Act remedy. So what we have claimed is that by the physical invasion and occupancy, the government has acquired title in these rights of way. But since Congress has withdrawn the Tucker Act remedy in FLIPMA, then the remedy that we get is not compensation, but to invalidate the taking, require the government to return the property. The attempt to invoke the Quiet Title
What's
Act
the
out
precedent
here,
for that in a takings claim?
I'm sorry?
What kind of precedent do you have for that remedy for a takings?
We have, in fact, I had that page set before. Here we go.
You have to show it's not for a public use, then.
We have Utah versus Andrus. Mm-hmm. As far as the physical invasion and occupancy, Loretto versus Teleprompter Cable Corporation, we cite
right.
that.
Now, I understand that, but to invalidate the taking, the government's allowed to take property, correct?
Yes,
for public uses, so long as they
correct remedy than that. And I have cited to it. Actually, it was
the remedy is compensation. The remedy is not to invalidate.
Ordinarily, Your Honor, that's correct.
Always, right?
No.
So long as it's for a public use.
Your Honor, not if Congress has withdrawn the Tucker Act remedy. Then the Fifth Amendment becomes self-executing, and we cite to Utah versus.
I agree on the self-executing point, but isn't the remedy still compensation?
I would respectfully disagree. When Congress has prohibited the exercise of that power. The government may have the authority to do it, but Congress giveth and Congress can taketh away. And if Congress has in statute...
And when Congress taketh away, the remedy is compensation.
Would you have any case to the contrary?
Utah versus Andrus. It's cited on page 33 of our complaint. It's 0031 in our appendix.
What is the relief in that case?
We believe that the relief in that case is to void the government action and return title.
What do you mean you believe? What is the
to the underlying property owner.
What does it say in the case? About
I don't have the quote in front of me, but it has been discussed in Utah versus Andrus. It's also been discussed in Symposium on Valid Existing Rights in the Mineral Law and Policy Journal, and Government Interference with Private Interests and Public Resources in the Harvard Law Review, 11 Harvard Law Review 1, 1987.
Okay, so we have the commentators rather than the
Well, we have so Utah far. Versus Andrus, which is a district court case out of Utah in 1979. We have Adams versus U.S., which is a Ninth Circuit case in 1993, all of which are cited in our complaint. Your Honor. But the second half, of course, is that they allege that a quiet title action is required on part of the non-county plaintiffs. We submit that it is not because the non-county plaintiffs are not alleging that they have any title. They're not claiming some kind of conflict in title that they have some in the government, and they are disputing whether the non-county plaintiffs or the government has title. They are relying also on the valid existing rights language in the Federal Land Policy Management Act and saying that it's therefore an ultra-virus action on the part of the government, which is addressable under the Administrative Procedure Act. So they can't possibly bring a quiet title claim because they're not alleging that they have title. But they are nevertheless entitled to rely on the violation of FLIPMA to claim that they are being aggrieved because they suffer injury if those roads are closed from the increased fire danger and so forth and so on that we had alleged and discussed at great length in our preliminary injunction motion before the court below, and which the court agreed we showed that if the harm occurred, it would be great harm. So they do have standing to bring that, and they are not required to go through the Quiet Title Act. And finally, Your Honor, we wanted to talk briefly about the Sabrifa claim. There are, as the court below acknowledged, there are very... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You've used all your time, including the time you retained for rebuttal. If you want to stop now, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
I do. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Michael Gray on behalf of the Forest Service. I will begin with the failure to revise the forest plan claim. And you know, as you noted, Judge Kavanaugh, Congress has repeatedly extended the deadline in these safe harbor provisions for making it so that the expiration of the 15-year period is not per se a violation of that provision. Instead, plaintiffs have to show a lack of expedition and good faith.
Do they have to show both or one?
Well, I think they have to show both. I think they have to show both that there's a lack of expedition, and if there is a lack of expedition, that lack of expedition is not in good faith. It would be difficult.
Would that be standard?
It would be difficult.
Grammar?
No, I think it is.
If the Secretary is not acting, and then there are two, there's an adverb and an adverbial prepositional phrase, then the section is void.
Yeah, I think it's the two go hand in hand in this case. It would be it's hard to imagine a case in which the Forest Service could be acting expeditiously but in bad faith. And so I think that what you first have to show is a lack of expedition, and then you have to show that lack of expedition is not making a good faith effort. I don't think the lack of expedition is enough. Otherwise, the good faith requirement essentially is meaningless because any time they are acting expeditiously, then I think they'll be acting in good faith. So I think you need both. And what the it does say is acting expeditiously and in good faith. And so I think what a plaintiff would have to allege in order to state a claim that you're not acting expeditiously is that the current actions of the Forest Service with respect to revising the plans are not expeditious. In other words, the failure to revise past the 15-year period is not itself enough to state a claim for lack of expedition.
I guess you would look at current activity in the light of past activity.
No, I think that's right, but I think the allegations would have to be, for example, that currently the Forest Service is not say they've gone through the 90-day public comment period after a scoping process, and then 2 years have gone by with no action, no indication of action. So they're no longer acting expeditiously to revise the forest plan. We don't have any of those sorts of allegations in the complaint. In this case, they're all based on this historical practice. And in fact, as we've noted, the Forest Service is actively engaged in attempting to revise the forest plan. In this case, Flathead National Forest Plan. And so I don't think that there's enough in this complaint to state a claim on lack of expedition.
Going back for a second to whether these are disjunctive or conjunctive requirements. If you're right that there's no such thing as a lack of expedition that is in good faith.
I think there would be no such thing as as expedition in bad faith.
Expedition in bad faith. Okay, then. We have not only the problem Judge Williams surfaced of the ordinary rules of construction, but we would have a problem of surplusage, wouldn't we?
No, I don't think so, because I think what Congress intended to say here is both, that you have a lack of expedition and that there's no good faith, effort here. In other words, you could have a lack of expedition that is in good faith. For example, in this case, the Forest Service has, attempted to revise the plan and then had the regulations pulled out from under them and have to go back. There's no indication that there's any sort of bad faith effort, even if you could conclude that was a lack of expedition. So I don't think it's surplusage. I think that a plaintiff has to come in and show both
But wait a minute. You've jumped over it by saying even if you could prove that that's a lack of expedition. But what you've described would seem not to be a lack of expedition. They could be proceeding as expeditiously as is humanly imaginable, and events beyond the control of the service, in this case the conduct of the department, prevents their coming to a conclusion.
Right. I think that's, in fact, what's happening. I don't think that makes it surplusage in the statute. It may be, a coupling, saying the same thing. Basically,
they're saying the same things twice. But
there's certainly some overlap in the two concepts.
It's getting pretty close to surplusage here.
Well, that may be, but I don't think that you can read it in any other way to make it make sense. And so I think that's
why wouldn't the disjunctive reading that Mr. Pelletov offers make perfect sense?
Well, because then you would be reading the good faith out. I assume that to the extent there is overlap, then if you're saying only a lack of expedition, if that includes some good faith element in a lack of expedition, then it may all just be an academic discussion and not really affect the rule in this case. The bottom line here is there's no allegations in the complaint to suggest either any sort of lack of expedition or any sort of bad faith effort to avoid revising the forest plan. It's clear that the Forest Service here has engaged in efforts to revise the forest plan as best as it can. Unless there are other questions, then I'll turn briefly to the Quiet Title Act.
Yeah, I'm looking at your passage, page 31, 32 of your brief, and it seems to treat non-property owners as evading the persons without a claim to the property as evading the Quiet Title Act. Quote the Seventh Circuit, by characterizing their complaint as a challenge to the federal government's regulatory authority. But I don't quite see how they have no title to quiet. So how is that you make it sound like an end run about end run of a requirement that applies to them? Why does it apply to them?
Well, I don't think that those individual plaintiffs could state a Quiet Title Act claim, but I don't think that that obviates the need. Just because you don't have a claim under the Quiet Title Act doesn't mean that you can bring a challenge that implicates the United States title in some other way. It just means you don't have a claim. That's the same thing that in Block, you know, the statute of limitations apply there, so there was no claim under the Quiet Title Act. Or if you have the Metropolitan Water District case out of the Ninth Circuit where you have Indian lands at issue, and they said there's no waiver of sovereign immunity for Indian lands, you can't bring a claim that would otherwise be a Quiet Title Act claim in some other way because there's no waiver of sovereign immunity there. The waiver of sovereign immunity...
We don't have a problem with the waiver of sovereign immunity because we have the APA, right?
Well, no, the courts have said that the APA does not supersede the Quiet Title Act, that the Quiet Title Act is the exclusive waiver of sovereign immunity for challenges to title. And at bottom here...
Challenges to title, but that's...
Well, at bottom here, what we're dealing with...
Your argument is that it would necessarily entail resolving the issue of title...
That's correct.
...in order to find illegality.
So, for example, if it's clear that an owner of a property, assume that they would own the property, own the rights away of these roads in this case, that they couldn't proceed in this manner. They would have to go through the Quiet Title Act. So then you could say, well, I'm going to have my neighbor... who doesn't own the property sue on the same thing to get around it.
You're hypothesizing a put-up case, but you don't establish that that is the relationship. So you have to
rely on broader theory. I understand that, but I do think that the implication is the same here, which is that, you know, if you have a third party who's ultimately you have to resolve whether the United States has title to the land or not, the exclusive way to do that is a Quiet Title Act claim. And if you can't state a Quiet Title Act claim, that just means you don't have a remedy. Not that there is some other way to get around it.
Can I ask you about proposition that FLTMA withdrew the remedy in the Tucker Act remedy?
I'm not sure I understand that argument. I don't think that FLTMA does anything to affect people's right to bring a just compensation action under the Fifth Amendment, under the Tucker Act. I just don't think that that's correct. I'm not sure where that comes from. But unless there are other questions... on either the exhaustion or the Small Business Act, then I will cede the remainder of my time and ask that the court affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Gray. Mr. Pollitt. I ask you to limit yourself to rebutting what you've heard rather than introducing new matter.
Yes, I would like to reinforce that the appellant's position that both expedition and good faith are required. I can certainly easily envision a situation in which the government was inexpeditious but was not acting in bad faith. Congress did put time limits in for a reason, even though they did, provide for an excuse that the mere passage of 15 years would alone not stand to be enough. However, we have to realize, I think, that even Congress, when they talk about the mere passage of 15 years, I don't think envision the situation in which we are now 8 years past and counting. The government has said that, they have these regulations that have been challenged and so forth and so on. But in 2001, the Forest Service had changed their regulations and had provided, quite appropriately, that the government may elect to proceed under the 1986 regulations or the 2000 regulations. I think it would defy common sense on the part of Congress to suggest that every time the government chooses to change its rules as to how to process an application or a revision, that a revision in process now must suddenly grind to a halt. I think that they are authorized. I think the Forest Service itself recognizes that these things need to go forward. And once, I believe, the Forest Service has made an election under which set of regulations to proceed, it has an obligation to follow through and apply the new rules to future action.
Can I just ask you a technical question? Where is it in your brief that you call our attention to the proposition that FLTMA withdrew the Tucker Act remedy?
I believe we cited to that in our brief. We cited to the appendix, page 33.
In your brief do you make this claim?
Okay, well, that discussion begins on page 40.
Where exactly does it make this contention about FLTMA?
Page 42, Your Honor.
Where on page 42?
About halfway down the first paragraph. It starts, indeed, as shown above in the plaintiff's opening brief, but for the withdrawal of Congress by the inclusion of valid existing rights language in the Federal Land Policy and Management Act and elsewhere of the authority from the executive branch's officials to take actions amounting to a taking with rights away, the matter might well be in the United States Court of Federal Claims or here.
That language to me is very elusive, at least as a contention that FLTMA withdrew the Tucker Act remedy.
Again, Your Honor, we cite that in the appendix.
You know, we start with the brief, and when the brief leads us on to interesting material in the appendix, we go there, but we don't search out every nook and cranny.
Well, we do allege on page 52 and going over to page 43 that the courts rejected the notion that there's a constitutional claim or they've exceeded their authority, a compensable taking of property, and goes on to discuss that this is, in fact, a claim, that the remedy itself is not the remedy itself is not money, because we would be in the claims court if we were seeking the money remedy. But
right,
that
I understand that.
Under
okay.
FLTMA, we are doing it. Anyhow,
Mr. Pollitt, I think you've used the time.
Okay.
The case is submitted. Thank you, Mr. Pollitt, Mr. Gray. Before the clerk calls the next case, we'll clear the courtroom of anyone who is not a member of the bar of this court or a member of the staff of the court, and we'll take a brief recess for that purpose.